as he lay down on the ledge outside the captain's quarters. Then she went back inside to see what could be done about the fire. There must have been some kind of ignite-on-impact paste in the sack that guy had covered the end of the bolt with. It felt strange to refer to it as a bolt now that she could see its size. It was more like a lamppost, its front end and the epicenter of the fire near the steering wheel, having missed the main mast, and the finned back end resting on the captain's table. Lord Shitflinger was losing his shit, figuratively speaking, shrieking as he jumped up into the shelves lining the walls and flinging all of Captain Longfellow's accumulated junk onto the table, like he was frantically searching for something specific.
"Stay calm!"
shouted Captain Longfellow down on the main deck.
"That was meant to stir us into a panic, for nothing be more frightening than a fire at sea. But remember, the heat rises. If they wanted to burn the ship down, they'd have aimed for us here on the main deck. It's my cargo they seek, so they mean to board us. So fear not the fire, but be ready to fight. Now, all ye poke-stroking, sperm-slurping scalawags, I ask ye, is everyone good?"
"Aye, Captain!"
the crew member shouted.
"I said, is everyone good?"
"Aye, Captain!"
the passengers joined the crew in responding this time.
"I can't hear ye!"
"Aye, Captain!"
To compare it to a pep rally before a high school football game seemed to undermine the gravity of the situation, but Catherine supposed the same psychological principles applied.
"I still can't hear ye!"
"Aye, Captain!"
They were giving it all they had. Catherine thought that Captain Longfellow might be, for lack of a better phrase, going a bit overboard. Then she had another thought. Was this meant for her? Asking if she, Butterbean, and Lord Shitflinger were okay without actually calling attention to the fact that he had her hiding in the captain's quarters.
"Ye all got cocks not in your lungs? For the last time, I said, is everyone good?"
Fearing those poor bastards down there might burst their lungs even before the boat was boarded, Catherine got up on her knees, making her head visible through the broken window. Captain Longfellow was staring right at her. She gave him a thumbs up and a nod. He gave her a wink and a grin.
"Very good, then," said the captain. "Prepare to fight!"
Passengers and crew alike cheered like there was nothing they wanted more than to fight for their very survival. If nothing else, Captain Longfellow's pep rally had indeed boosted morale. How much effect that would have on the upcoming fight remained to be seen. Black smoke thickened as more of it flowed out past Catherine, the newly broken window being the only route it had to escape the captain's quarters. The fire was spreading, and Lord Shitflinger still hadn't found whatever the hell it was he'd been seeking. His search wasn't the most efficient, but it was surprisingly systematic for a monkey. He hopped from the left side of the room to the right, then back again, completely clearing the shelves, getting as close to the fire as he could without burning himself. What the hell was he trying to find? Maybe one of these pieces of junk could help put out the fire. Giving the shelves a cursory scan, she looked for something like a decanter of endless water, but found nothing even remotely similar looking. If only she could... well, shit. Of course she could. Focusing her mind on Lord Shitflinger, she said, "Speak!" The monkey ceased his frantic emptying of shelves and turned his head to look at Catherine.
"What did you say?"
"No time to explain," said Catherine. "I want to help you." Lord Shitflinger glared at her.
Then what are you waiting for? My permission?"
"I need to know what you're looking for so I can help you find it."
"I'm not looking for anything, stupid half-elf. I'm trying to salvage what I can of Captain Longfellow's treasures."
Catherine scanned the room. Most of the shelves were obscured by smoke, but she remembered well enough the sort of pirate garage sale shit that was on them. "All of this junk?"
"Junk?"
Lord Shitflinger coughed as he picked up a pointed bronze helmet. He seemed to consider throwing it at Catherine, but tossed it down onto the table.
Each piece of what you call junk holds a memory dear to the captain from his many voyages around the world."
He started choking violently, then tossed down some dusty, primitive-looking wind instrument.
"Who are you to belittle what my captain holds dear?"
There was only a finite amount of remorse Catherine would allow herself to feel when being lectured by a monkey, but she conceded he had a point.
"Stay on that side," she said. "I'll clear this side."
Catherine had a much easier time clearing her side. Instead of picking up one piece of old trash at a time and tossing it down onto the table, she held her bag of holding open with her left hand and bulldozed the contents of each shelf into it with her right arm. Once her side was done, she helped Lord Shitflinger clear his side. After both sides were clear, Catherine told him to put all the shit he'd tossed onto the table into the bag of holding in case she couldn't put out or at least contain the fire. The speak with animals spell had long since timed out, so she had to pantomime. But Lord Shitflinger, being a clever little monkey, seemed to catch on after watching her make a show of putting items into the bag. When he took over bag packing duties, Catherine focused on the spreading fire. She needed water, and they were floating on a literal ocean of it. There must be some obvious solution she wasn't seeing. How could she get water from down there to up here? The smoke started to fill the room faster as the fire grew. Catherine squatted down until her face was level with the table where Lord Shitflinger was just about finished putting the last of Captain Longfellow's shit in the bag of holding. She quickly shoved the rest of the junk into the bag while she thought of the best way to get a bunch of water into it. Although it didn't feel like the wisest option in the world, she didn't have time to think of anything better than the obvious. She'd have to go for a swim. Getting into the water was easy enough, but even if she tethered herself to the boat with a rope, it was going to be a challenge to climb. Oh, wait. No, it wasn't. Catherine put her finger to her temple. Spider bitch! She felt a discharge of magic, but didn't feel any sudden inclination to fight crime or shit rope. Had it worked? She placed her hands on the wall and attempted to pull herself up. The change was a little stomach-turning. It felt like the force of gravity had shifted, exclusively for her, toward the wall she was focused on. She could crawl up it as if the whole ship had turned on its side. Fucking awesome! Unfortunately, gravity was still working normally for the air around her, which was denser with smoke the further she climbed up the wall. Holding her breath and closing her eyes, she made it to the ceiling, and was delighted to find that she could just as effortlessly crawl upside down. Feeling her way out the window, she climbed out onto the roof of the captain's quarters, where she was able to see and breathe again. The black boat was now within normal crossbow range, and sailors on both ships were taking random pot shots at each other. Catherine didn't bother with ladders as she climbed down the tiers of the central cabin structure, with everyone concentrating on the left side of the maiden's voyage, where the other boat was approaching. She was able to remain unseen as she hopped over the rail on the right side and attached herself to the side of the boat's hull. Spider bitch or not, the force of the water could easily sweep her off the boat if she didn't have something sturdy to hold on to. The hull was pretty smooth and slick with ocean spray. It wouldn't take a whole lot of force to send her out to sea. She considered crawling to the front of the boat, letting the force of the water press her back to the hull, but dismissed the idea almost instantly. She'd only be swept underneath, perhaps getting knocked unconscious in the process. Instead, she headed for the rear of the boat, hoping that she'd be able to grab onto the rudder or something. Even better, there were two ladders running up the rear. Catherine grabbed a rung tightly with her left hand and held the bag of holding open even more tightly with her teeth and her right hand, letting the movement of the boat force water into it. A sudden burning pain in her right ass cheek nearly caused her to let go of both the ladder and the bag, but she held on. "Yow!" she cried, freeing the bag from her teeth's grip. She turned around and spotted two sailors on the black boat laughing and pointing down at her. Fucking assholes. One of them wore striped green and white pants and was holding a crossbow, the missing projectile of which was likely sticking out of her ass, and the other had a bushy red beard. Satisfied that the bag of holding had a sufficient supply of water, and she'd recognize these two shitheads if she saw them again, she scrambled back to the right side of the boat and up to the main deck. After double-checking to make sure she was out of anyone's crossbow sight and still out of view to anyone aboard the maiden's voyage, she grabbed hold of the railing, shut her eyes tight, and plucked the bolt out of her ass. It was a minor wound, and she'd have a hole in the ass of her jeans with a blood stain running down from it, but she'd survive. Ignoring her ass soreness, she continued crawling up the side of the boat until she found Butterbean and Lord Shitflinger on the narrow ledge separating the captain's quarters from the tier below it. The inside was filled with thick black smoke, so much so that Catherine couldn't even see the flames anymore. She reached into the bag of holding for something she could use to break the other windows. If she could get more smoke flowing out, she might not have to work without being able to see or breathe. "Spyglass," she said. Of all Captain Longfellow's junk she had scooped into the bag, That was the most club-like item she could recall. When she felt it in her hand, she pulled it out and struck a window with it. The window cracked, but didn't shatter. Thankfully, the spyglass did neither. For two hollow wooden tubes, it was a surprisingly sturdy instrument. Rather than swing with her next strike, she attacked the window with the eyepiece of the spyglass, wielding it more like an ice pick than a club. That connected much more solidly, obliterating the window and allowing another plume of dark smoke to shoot out sideways. After destroying three more windows on the right side of the captain's quarters, Catherine could finally see the flames. They had spread further along the interior walls, but not by much, and they hadn't yet eaten through to the outside. Captain Longfellow might not actually have to completely rebuild his top tier. As Catherine prepared to douse the fire with the water she'd collected in her bag of holding, she considered the issue of delivery. If she just let the water out of the bag, it would dump out at her feet, and the heat was too intense for her to get close enough to the fire to be effective. But she hadn't taken a bolt in the ass to give up now. Come on, Catherine, think! She remembered her black friend and his knack for improvisation. What would Tanner do? And lo and behold, there was the answer, right in her hand. She unscrewed the eyepiece and the lens on the far end, and carefully put both into the bag of holding, just in case what she was about to do left the spyglass tube still intact. She then bunched the mouth of the bag around the larger of the two spyglass tubes, but left enough room for her to be able to poke in a single finger. Catherine didn't know a lot about water pressure or magical bags. She didn't know the rate at which the water would flow out, whether or not that depended on the total amount of water being summoned at one time, or exactly how much pressure she'd need to get a good enough propulsion without shooting herself backwards through the wall like Daffy Duck. She'd start with a low amount and test it from there. Dipping a finger into the bag, she said, 10 gallons of water! Then she quickly pulled her finger out and wound the drawstring tight around the bunched-up mouth. Casual vomiting was the best way she could think of how to describe how the water gurgled out of the narrow end of the spyglass. She wouldn't be putting out any fires like that. But thus was the nature of experimentation. From what she'd observed, she guessed she could safely take it up a few notches. She loosened the drawstring around the mouth of the bag and reinserted her finger. 50 gallons of water! She sensed the coming blast and didn't bother with the drawstring. Instead, she bunched the bag around the end of the spyglass as tightly as she could with both hands. Water gushed out a little more powerfully, allowing Catherine to move forward and douse some flames, cutting off the ground the fire had been gaining. Shortly after the initial gush started, it slowed down to a weak trickle, and she determined that she still hadn't gotten anywhere close to dangerous levels yet.
100 gallons of water!
The water flowed out a little more strongly, and the stream lasted about twice as long, allowing Catherine to drown out a considerable section of the fire. Even the smoke was beginning to thin out, and still, Catherine didn't feel the slightest threat of being propelled backwards.
500 gallons of water!
The next thing she knew, Catherine's back slammed against the rear wall of the captain's quarters, and the front windows shattered like she'd hit them with a full magazine from an assault rifle. Thankful to have been spared the injury and embarrassment of flying through the wall, she concentrated her makeshift fire hose on what remained of the fire, drowning it and leaving the captain's quarters charred, smoky, and sopping wet, but ultimately intact. Hell, she'd even managed to spare the windows on the left side of crash, 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 crash. All of the windows on the left side of the captain's quarters exploded in rapid succession as large steel projectiles burst through them from outside. They thunked on the floor, then receded by the cords they were attached to, catching the windowsills with their sharp barbs. Grappling hooks. The sailors from the other ship were beginning to board the maiden's voyage. As she peered out the window, Catherine tried to remember whether or not she had a dagger to cut the ropes with. It didn't matter. The sailors whom these ropes belonged to had already swung aboard and were clashing their large curved blade swords against the far less flashy version Captain Longfellow had issued to his passengers. Most of the carnage was concentrated on the rear deck, where the crewmen of the Nightwind, Catherine could now make out the enemy boat's name engraved on the front of its black hull, were ferociously cutting down the Maiden's Voyage's passengers. The swords Captain Longfellow's crew had issued them might as well have been big rubber dicks for all the use they were getting out of them. Not that Catherine had any room to judge them. Incompetent or not, at least they weren't hiding from the fight. If she were still a vampire, this fight would have already been over. and she would be chumming the waters with these dumb motherfuckers. Squinting in the sunlight, she reflected that her assessment of that hypothetical fight was incorrect. She would have been in the bag of holding even more useless than she was right now. Captain Longfellow himself fought like a badass, and his crewmen could hold their own pretty well. Catherine wasn't able to spot Denise, but Randy was proving himself to be a far more competent fighter than Catherine ever imagined he could be. Still, the tide of battle was clearly not going their way. The deck was painted with blood, occasionally dotted with severed arms and dropped swords. Catherine would have picked up a sword and jumped into the fray, but they slid off the deck almost as soon as they were dropped. She could see Captain Longfellow's objection to her scythe. There simply wasn't enough room to swing it on the crowded deck. She'd just be a nuisance to all these people trying to kill each other. That left her the options of trying to clobber people with a spyglass or trying to pull a bag of holding down over their heads, neither of which seemed like a productive enough use of her effort to risk almost certain death. While she wondered what kind of effect a sudden barrage of dire rat corpses might have, a horn sounded from the Night Wind's deck. It blasted loud over the grunts, screams, and clashing of swords, blowing long and evenly for a full 10 seconds. By the time it stopped, so had most of the fighting. The entire crew of Night Wind stood at attention, as did Captain Longfellow and his crewmen. A few passengers, who were either unaware of horn-blowing protocols or just trying to get in a cheap shot, were quickly subdued with punches in the face from the crew of both ships. Across the web of ropes which were holding the two boats together, Catherine recognized the hornblower. The last time she'd seen him in his goofy green and white striped pants, he'd been holding a crossbow rather than a horn. Both of those would be up his ass by the time she was done with him. The man next to him, dolled up in furs and jewels so as to make sure everyone knew who the captain of that ship was at the very first glance, was too fat to have lived a life at sea. His hair was long and brown, perfectly curled, and absolutely a wig. His face was powdered white, and his lips painted red. He was like a caricature of royalty that wanted to be taken seriously.
"Good day, Captain of Maiden's Voyage," said the other captain in a voice he should have been ashamed of.
"Aye," said Captain Longfellow, his voice filled with resignation. "Good day, Captain of Night Wind."
"I offer you an end to this needless bloodshed. Would you hear my terms?"
Captain Longfellow beheld all the dead and dying on his deck. Many more of those whose blood painted the deck red were under his charge.
"State your demands, Captain."
He spat out the last word as if he was disgusted by having to recognize such a man as his equal. Night Wind's captain smiled and took hold of the rope the hornblower was offering him. Catherine followed the rope up with her eyes and found it was hanging from a yard jutting out from the main mast. Neither the rope nor the yard seemed to serve any purpose but to provide an easy swing for someone who wasn't used to swinging from boat to boat. Even with a pre-constructed junior pirate swinging rope set up, the captain's swing across was anything but graceful. Catherine held her breath when it looked like he was going to fall in the water, but two of his men caught him by the arms and pulled him aboard the Maiden's Voyage.
"Greetings, fellow seamen,"
Nightwind's captain announced, prompting a snort from Randy.
"You may call me Captain Martin Noly. I very much look forward to commanding those of you I find worthy to man my vessels."
Randy snorted again, then tried to play it off as a sneeze. Catherine thought it was a stretch to take anything dirty from Captain Martinoli's last statement and assumed that Randy was just having a fit of the giggles.
"And those ye don't find worthy?"
asked Captain Longfellow.
"Those who are able-bodied will be sent to work in the Castiglian volcano mines. Those who aren't will be made use of in other ways."
Catherine's first interpretation was that he meant to feed those who had lost limbs in the fight to monsters they kept domesticated on their islands. She hoped she was wrong, but Captain Longfellow's sigh suggested her instincts were spot on. She didn't envy the choice he had to make right now. He could save some of them, as far as sending them to spend the rest of their lives as slaves in volcanic mines could be considered saving, or he could refuse Captain Martinoli's offer and condemn them all to a quicker death here and now.
"As for my demands,"
Captain Martinoli continued,
"I expect nothing less than your unconditional surrender, your boat, and whatever cargo you have on board."
This is a passenger vessel, said Captain Longfellow. We carry no cargo.
Captain Martinoli shook his head as he sauntered over to the cargo bay.
I had hoped that our relationship would begin on better terms. Honestly, what's the point in lying to me now? I did my research, consulted my little fish. I know the maiden's voyage was scheduled to deliver a load of dire tiger hides to Stormwind on your way back from Baran.
Your little fishes gave you bad information. The Falcon was caught in a storm. The delivery's been delayed.
Captain Longfellow's tone was smug. Even if he was forced to surrender his boat, he could at least have the spiteful satisfaction of knowing that Captain Martinoli wouldn't be getting the cargo he'd expected from him. Captain Martinoli sighed.
Ugh. Open the cargo door.
Two of his crewmen went to the rear of the ship and started cranking the winches which lowered the cargo door. Catherine considered that Captain Longfellow may have had another trick up his sleeve. He was looking at Randy now, who knew what was down in the cargo hold and had as good an opportunity as anyone on the ship to give Captain Martinoli a little shove now that the Nightwind crewman who'd just been next to him was now turning the winch. Unfortunately, Captain Longfellow and Randy were operating under two very different codes of honor. Catherine appreciated how Captain Longfellow had orchestrated the conversation so that this opportunity presented itself before he formally declared his surrender, but a paladin's code was much less letter of the law than that. Randy wasn't about to sucker shove an unarmed man into a cargo hold to be eaten by a giant lizard.
I might have let you continue to captain this ship,
Captain Martinoli continued to Captain Longfellow.
Under my direct command, of course.
Captain Longfellow's expression grew grim as Randy failed to act on his nods and winks, and his fate seemed further sealed. Catherine felt bad for him and for all the crewmen and passengers who'd be sold into slavery or fed to monsters. But more importantly, she had shit to take care of, and this fat, curly-haired fuck was delaying her. She lay down flat on top of the bag of holding and pointed the spyglass nozzle at Captain Martinoli, who was still droning on.
But I fear I cannot trust you just yet. You may serve as crewman on Nightwind, working your way up the ranks, and perhaps one day be allowed to serve aboard the Maiden's Voyage as first mate to a captain whose loyalty I needn't ever call into question. If you perform to his satisfaction, then maybe someday...
All the water!
If the initial blast of water didn't crack Captain Martinoli's sternum, the spyglass tube certainly did when she lost control of it. Catherine hadn't been sure how much water she had left to work with and wanted to make this shot count. As it turned out, it was a hell of a lot, and it packed quite a bit of force. Fortunately, the initial blast and spyglass tube were enough to push Captain Martinoli backwards into the cargo hold, where his yelp turned into a mixture of screams and chomps, then got suddenly and uncomfortably quiet. In the following awkward silence, Catherine discovered that Captain Martinoli's death didn't necessarily guarantee that his men would surrender. She found it difficult to believe they'd had any sincere sense of loyalty to a man who'd obviously acquired his position through money alone. The loss of Captain Martinoli did absolutely nothing to shift the balance of power should they all decide to start fighting again, and any one of the Nightwind's crew could progress from a mere deckhand to the commander of a two-ship fleet and rightfully claim he'd earned it. But which one would it be? Nightwind's men were all sizing up each other rather than paying attention to any of the crew or passengers of the Maiden's Voyage.
I was first mate, said the man with the bushy red beard who'd laughed at Catherine when his buddy shot her in the ass. It stands to reason that I am now the captain of Nightwind.
You were a good first mate,
said a shirtless, muscular black man with hieroglyphic-looking tattoos covering his bald head and running down his neck and out to his shoulders.
But there is more to captaining a ship than sucking Martinoli's cock.
Several of Nightwind's men standing near him laughed. Those would no doubt be his faction if things turned ugly.
I have said the longest of any of us,
the large man continued.
It is I who should be captain.
A man with a bloodied steel pitchfork for a left hand stepped forward.
The crew should decide who they wish to sail under.
After a round of agreeing cheers, he added,
I nominate myself!
Catherine had a stupid idea and decided to run with it. She got to her feet and put her hands on her hips.
Fuck all that,
she called down, drawing the attention of both ship's crews. I killed Martinoli. I'm your new goddamn captain. The crew laughed, which she'd been expecting. She waited for it to die down, then addressed the deck again.
You're already bickering among yourselves. You'll kill each other before you unite and agree to sail under one of your own. Then there won't be enough of you left to fight the crew of this ship. Sailing under an outsider is the only option most of you have if you want to see another sunrise.
The opposing Nightwind factions eyed each other. Their choices came down to killing each other or sailing under Captain Cat. She tried not to look too smug. The large black sailor looked up at her, his face serious.
If you agree to set free those of us who don't wish to sail under you, we shall recognize you as Captain of Nightwind and take you as far as the first port you wish to travel to.
He turned around, inviting the rest of the Nightwind crew to agree with the terms he'd just laid out. He was met with a bunch of nods and resigned grunts. Catherine saw Captain Longfellow in the crowd. He shrugged and nodded. There might be a better deal to be made, but this would do. It would be wise to release those crewmen who wanted to leave and keep only those who would be loyal to her. She made and held eye contact with the big black guy.
I accept your people's terms.
Shit.
And by that, I mean the crew of the Nightwind, of course.
The sailor eyed her warily.
Of course.
Obviously, said Catherine, despite Randy encouraging her to stop talking by wagging his fingertips in front of his throat. Because what else would I have meant by that? Let's just get back on the ship, okay?
As her new crew swung, swam, or climbed across ropes back to Nightwind, Captain Longfellow barked orders for his own crew. Tend to the wounded, save the dead and severed body parts for Chum, swab the deck, then he pointed at Catherine.
I'll have a word with ye, Captain, if you don't mind.
Even though his tone was heavy with sarcasm when he said the word Captain, Catherine liked the way it sounded. While he started climbing the ladder, Catherine beckoned Butterbean and went into the captain's quarters. She wiped water off a chair with her hand, then sat down.
It was some impressive negotiations ye did down there, said the captain, as he entered through the door and gloomily surveyed the scorched walls and the charred remains of the shelves. And a fine job ye did putting out this fire.
Thank you, said Catherine, sensing he was about to follow up with a but.
But, he followed up, a captured ship is a captain's prize. I know ye live by land customs, but such are the ways of the sea. Mighty grateful I am ye saving me ship, me crew, most of me passengers, perhaps even me life. But I cannot allow ye to.
That's not all I saved.
Catherine placed the bag of holding on the table and smirked down at Lord Shipflinger. Reaching inside the bag, she said,
Captain Longfellow's shit.
A pile of old junk spilled out.
Me treasures!
The captain's face was like a child's who'd just gotten a puppy for Christmas.
I cannot believe it! I thought for sure they were all lost in the fire!
Lord Shipflinger told me how important all this stuff is to you, so I thought you might appreciate me keeping it safe.
If there was ever an appropriate time and place to call in a favor, this was it.
So what is it you were saying?
Captain Longfellow paused, looking up from the bronze statuette of a large-breasted naked woman's torso he was admiring.
Now that ye mention it, I can't seem to recall, Captain.
He emphasized Captain again, but this time it was loaded with acknowledgement rather than sarcasm. Catherine put the bag of holding on the floor and held it open for Butterbean.
Come on, Butterbean. Let's go check out our new ship.
Chapter 31. Hollyworld delegated tasks and duties to her pixie kin in preparation for the morning's journey. Five would stay behind to look after the secret glade and continue to produce more light wards, which kept the dark ones at bay, or at least easier to spot. It wasn't a perfect solution, as Dimplethorn had explained to Chaz when he'd asked about them. The trees and forest creatures depended on the natural cycles of day and night. Permanent light would weaken the forest, and so few pixies as they numbered could only hope to patrol a limited area. Still, it was the best idea they could come up with, so for the time being, they would continue to make light wards. Dimplethorn had been assigned the task of tending to the animals, which included feeding the boar and healing Ravenous's wing, which had broken when Hollyworld shot him unconscious in flight.
Be still, little bird,
she said in a British accent, cradling Ravenous's head in her lap as he groaned. She held a tiny pixie-sized water skin that looked like it was made out of a squirrel stomach over his beak, ready to upend it down his throat as soon as he started to behave himself.
"I don't want to drink it," squawked Ravenous. "It smells of honey and wildflowers. Absolutely disgusting."
"It's good for you. It will mend your wing and allow you to fly free again."
"Come on, Ravenous," said Chaz. "Just drink it. Julian would want you to drink it."
He didn't give a shit about Ravenous or his wing, but he wanted him to shut up.
"Very well, then," Ravenous huffed. "I'll do it for my master's sake."
He made a show of coughing and gagging as Dimple Thorn poured the potion down his throat, like he thought he deserved a purple heart for getting it down. When it was finished, he let out a loud, inarticulate squawk and ruffled his feathers. Then he breathed heavily as he flapped his wings.
"My, but that was refreshing."
Dimple Thorn smiled at him.
"Didn't I tell you? All better now?"
"I wouldn't object to having my cloaca rubbed."
"Perhaps another time."
Dimplethorn shoved Ravenous's big bird head off her lap, stood up, and walked over to Chaz.
"You dress more colorfully than other humans I've seen."
Now that she was done with her official duties for the evening, it was apparently time to annoy Chaz with observations about him and questions about life in the city, most of which he didn't feel qualified to answer. His annoyance had more to do with him being preoccupied with the fact that he still had barely enough strength to lift his head than it had to do with her genuinely being annoying, and he reminded himself every time he spoke not to be an asshole. He knew he should have been grateful that she was kind enough to talk to him at all. Most of the other pixies were either shy or distrustful of him and Cooper, and Zanzifurl to a lesser degree. Dimplethorn, either because she was enlightened enough to know that all outsiders weren't dangerous, or because she thought she could easily take him in a fight, chose to remain visible in such close proximity to him. She had pale blue skin, green hair, which matched her form-fitting dress, made of woven long-bladed grass, and shiny orange wings. If you looked past the facts that she was only 2.5 feet tall and part bug, she was a very attractive woman. And also, to Dimplethorn's credit, Chaz didn't find her to be careful about how she answered his questions or selective about what information she was giving him. She could give as well as she received, which would have been great if Chaz could have thought of anything useful to ask her.
"It's what I was wearing when I arrived in the ga-"
He still had to stop himself from referring to these people's entire world and existence as a game.
"I'm a bard. We tend to seek attention."
Dimplethorn clapped delightedly.
"Oh, that's fascinating."
Chaz was so accustomed to being ridiculed for his class that he had to replay her response in his head a number of times to determine if she was making fun of him. Against his ego's self-preservation instinct telling him it was a trap, he came to the conclusion that she actually thought it was cool that he was a bard. Why wouldn't she? Bards were the rock stars of this game. They create magic through the power of rock. The only people he'd spent any significant amount of time with since he'd been here were all gamer nerds who looked down on bards for not being able to kick as much ass in a straight-up one-on-one fight against someone of a different class. He should have been out making bank, fucking groupies, and getting the sort of respect he was due. He shrugged.
"It beats working."
"Can you play me a song?"
"A song?"
said a nearby pixie voice. It could have been male, but it was difficult to tell.
"Does this one play songs?"
"I play songs," said Zanzifurl.
"We've heard satyr songs before."
Dimplethorn stood on her root and gestured at Chaz like he was an exhibit.
"This one is a bard from the city."
"Oh, how exciting,"
said a male pixie, which Chaz could only be certain of because he made himself visible, landing next to Dimplethorn and taking a seat on her root. A female became visible right next to Chaz, nearly causing him to fall backwards off the root he was sitting on.
"Play us a city song, something you'd play to a burly group of ruffians and ne'er-do-wells."
Her knowledge of city life in this game world sounded close to his own.
"Oh, I'm sorry," said Chaz. "I don't have an instrument. My lute was destroyed when I fell out of the sky and landed on a giant tomato."
Dimplethorn turned to Zanzifurl.
"It would give us great pleasure if you would allow the bard to blow your instrument."
"Holy shit,"
said Cooper, materializing at the perimeter of the glade as he walked out of the illusory terrain between two light wards.
"Did I just come back at the wrong time?"
He thought for a moment.
Or is it the rat time?
He looked at Chaz.
Just so you know, it wouldn't arouse me in the least, but if you're going to blow a goat man, I think I'd want to watch.
I am not a goat man,
cried Zanzaferl. He was still sulking about nobody wanting to hear him play his own pipes. To take his pipes away from him and play to an adoring crowd would be kicking him while he was down, especially right after the goat man comment.
Really, I wish I could play something for you, but I'm much better with string instruments than I am with wind instruments.
I've got a wind instrument,
said Cooper. He squatted and let out an impressively long and controlled fart. The pixie named Hickory Nut appeared above Cooper, then flew even higher.
How is it that you could possibly have anything left to expel after what we just witnessed?
When a group of pixies had raised their concerns about the smell of Cooper's shits, Hollywhirl had assigned Hickory Nut and two other unfortunate pixies to escort him out of the glade to do his business.
Please, Bard,
said Zanzaferl, holding out his pipes.
Delight us all with a song.
Chaz thought for a moment on what might have prompted Zanzaferl's sudden change of heart. Then he remembered how shittily he'd performed the previous day. It was good enough to light up an acorn, but it was far from entertaining. This goatman asshole wanted to watch him fail in front of an excited crowd. Then, whatever mediocre melody he performed afterward would be all the more appreciated.
Yes,
said Dimplethorn.
Please play us a song.
Other pixies made themselves visible around her, sitting cross-legged in the grass. Even Hollywhirl watched curiously, her arms crossed as she hovered above them. Shit. Chaz accepted the pipes from a smirking Zanzaferl. What a shithead. Why couldn't he have an instrument that didn't require a mouth to play? Chaz wouldn't be able to play and sing at the same time. He tried to think of something with a lot of harmonica in it. Like a rolling stone. Could he pull off Dylan? He was 100% sure that he couldn't. At least not for anyone who'd ever heard the song before. He was no Dylan, and these wooden satyr pipes were no substitute for a harmonica in a band full of musicians and other instruments. But maybe, if he rolled well enough, he could pull off a version of the song that would entertain this group of forest-dwelling fae folk who'd never even heard the shit that passed for music in their own world, much less actual real music. He blew the pipes quietly at first to get a feel for them again. As random sounds gradually morphed into something like the tune that he was going for, he blew louder and more confidently. Most of the assembled crowd exchanged awkward glances as he played, but Dimplethorn was laser-focused on him. She closed her eyes and smiled, like she was trying to meet him halfway, maybe trying to imagine what it might sound like if performed properly with a band and a singer who could remember more than 70% of the lyrics. When he came around to the chorus a second time, the other pixies began to pay more attention, like they were now starting to recognize the structure of the song. As he progressed into the third and fourth verses with bolstered confidence, he felt something like a mixture of two familiar feelings flowing out of him at once. One was the rush that came from a crowd digging his music. The other feeling, the release of magical energy he felt whenever he cast a spell, wasn't really separate from the first. It had always been there, even when he'd played in bars or rocked the shit on karaoke night back home. There was power in music, and he was only beginning to learn how to harness it. The song ended with a round of applause as thunderous as was possible from 24 tiny bug people. Chaz wanted to coolly toss the pipes back to Zanzaferl, but repeatedly lifting them to his mouth had taken a lot out of him. Instead, he waited for the satyr to come and retrieve them.
I am humbled by your performance,
said Zanzaferl, bowing as he accepted his instrument.
I have never heard music like that before.
Thank you.
Chaz was moved by Zanzaferl's words, and thankful that he'd opted not to tell him to go fuck himself when he handed back the pipes.
Be it the will of the gods that we return from tomorrow's journey alive, I would be honored if we could exchange our knowledge of music.
That sounds awesome,
said Chaz.
Maybe when I get myself a new lute, we could jam together.
Zanzaferl's smile faltered.
Of course, we could do that as well.
Neither bush nor vine yields fruit without bees to pollinate their flowers,
said Hollywhirl in a peculiar interruption and change of subject.
Until the Dark Lord and his minions are driven from this wood, no one will make jam together.
I meant...
Chaz changed his mind and decided to let it go. He was too exhausted to teach English colloquialisms, even if not doing so meant they'd think he had some weird fixation on making liquefied fruit.
It's not just the jam, it's the whole ecosystem. The absence of berries throws the whole food chain out of whack.
He thought that had been a good save, but Holly Whirl was staring at him with what felt like contempt for his idiocy.
Thank you for your performance,
she finally said, though there was little warmth in her tone.
It was both entertaining and thought-provoking. Perhaps you would entertain us again sometime, but for now you must rest. We have a long day of travel ahead of us.
That sounds fine by me,
said Cooper.
I'm about to rest like a motherfucker.
He collapsed right where he was standing, dead center of the perimeter of light wards, which is precisely where Chaz had meant to sleep, having determined it the safest possible place if a dark one should happen into the glade. He tried to think of some reason to ask Cooper to sleep somewhere else, but the best he could come up with was, you should sleep in a more dangerous place because I don't want to die or have to smell you. That wasn't likely to go over well, so it came down to a choice between sleeping next to Cooper and having to smell him all night, or putting his own life more at risk. That was the kind of decision that put one's logic forcing into overdrive. If a Dark One were to enter the glade, it would do so from a random point along the perimeter. If Chaz were sleeping near the perimeter, there would be more points of entry further from him than the perimeter's radius, which would be the distance it would have to travel if Chaz was sleeping at the center, than there would be nearer him. So logically, the safest place he could sleep would be at a random point along the edge. Does that make sense? That makes sense. Fuck, I'm tired. Chaz crawled from the stump he'd been sitting on toward the edge of the glade.
You there, Bard,
said Holly Whirl.
You'll be safer in the center of the glade, next to your friend.
He looked up in the direction her voice was coming from, but she, along with most of the other pixies, had turned invisible again.
No, you see, a random point on the perimeter, the radius of the glade is shorter. This was easier to articulate in my head. If you consider that...
We have limited resources with which to protect you. You're easier to watch over if you're all together. Now you and the satyr should lie down next to the half-orc before you further test my patience.
Chaz glanced over at Zanzifurl, who had also decided to try his luck on the edge of the glade. With resigned sighs, they both shuffled toward Cooper.
Hickory Nut, Wildflower,
said Holly Whirl.
Retrieve the half-orc's axe.
Cooper opened his eyes.
Seriously? You let me carry it around all evening. What do you think I'm going to do while I'm sleeping?
Believe me, half-orc, when I say I'm not frightened of you. But if that is truly my sister, then the way you sleep with her makes me uncomfortable.
What the fuck are you talking about?
You're cuddling it.
Cooper sat up and pushed the axe a couple of inches away from him.
No, I wasn't.
As the axe floated away from him, he shouted up after it.
You know, this isn't cool, man. It's fine if you want to take the axe away, but don't make me out to be some kind of fucking axe molester. It's not like I was dry humping it or shoving the handle at my ass.
I'm not accusing you of anything,
explained Holly Whirl.
The children of the forest do not judge others' sexual habits. We are essentially enlightened people. In fact, most of us are currently enjoying the acts of love as I speak.
Chaz felt something warm and wet drip onto the back of his neck as he crawled toward Cooper. He sat up, wiped it off, then looked at his fingers. It looked like glitter glue.
What the fuck is this?
He whispered to himself. He almost had a heart attack when two invisible hands grabbed him by the wrist. Then an invisible tongue licked the substance he sincerely hoped he'd misidentified from his fingers.
Who is that?
It tastes like dandelion,
Dimplethorn whispered back, remaining invisible.
But it could be huckleberry.
Those dark ones really took it out of me,
Chaz called out to anyone who was listening.
I'll be there in a second,
he whispered to Dimplethorn.
You know the taste of each of these guys' splooge?
I'd like to know the taste of your splooge.
Chaz's dick was threatening to burst through the front of his shiny golden pants, which disturbed him for all sorts of reasons. They weren't even the same species. What the hell could they even do together? Would his dick fit inside her? If it did, then it would mean that either he had a tiny dick or she had a vag like a subway tunnel. Did she even stop at pixies? If she wanted to fuck him, Who's to say she hadn't fucked wolves and bears? He already had one foot in the grave without throwing bear AIDS onto his pile of health issues. Or maybe she wasn't talking about intercourse. Maybe she just wanted to jerk him off because she was genuinely curious as to what his splooge tasted like. But those tiny hands would make it like getting a hand job from an infant. And where the hell would they do it? Out here in the grass? Cooper would never let him live that down.
You may have your axe in the morning,
Hollywhirl said to Cooper.
Should we discover that Nabi's spirit dwells within it, and she personally gives her consent for you to lay with her, then you may.
I'm not trying to bone your fucking sister.
Chaz felt Dimplethorn's hands reach under his pants. His elbows went wobbly, causing him to lose balance and plant his face in the moist grass. There was no stopping it now. It was happening. Just hang on a little longer, man. Don't shoot your load as soon as she touches your... He shot his load as soon as she touched his dick.
What you and my sister do is none of my concern,
Hollywhirl continued.
If she chooses to lay with a half-orc, that makes no more difference to me than Dimplethorn's decision to caress the bard's penis to ejaculation.
Cooper stared wide-eyed at Chaz.
No,
cried Chaz.
She didn't. I...
He's right,
said Dimplethorn, though the sound of her voice right next to him did little to corroborate her denial.
I barely touched it.
Cooper snorted and gawked at Chaz's crotch. Dimplethorn had taken most of his load when she removed her hand, but he still felt a little sticky, and there was a visible wet spot on the crotch of his pants.
It's been a while since I've been with anyone, okay?
It's saltier than I expected,
Dimplethorn whispered in his ear.
I'm going to save some in a jar.
As disturbing as that was, Chaz was even more disturbed by the fact that, in the very near future, perhaps 10 minutes from now when his post-squirt hormones died down, he would probably be aroused by knowing a tiny winged woman was keeping a sample of his jizz in a jar. He scrambled the rest of the way to the center of the glade on his weak hands and knees and collapsed face down on the grass, mostly because he was too exhausted to do anything else, but also with the purpose of covering his junk.
Did you touch her tits?
Cooper said in a lousy attempt at a whisper. Chaz covered his head with his arms.
Shut up! Let me go to sleep!
We're going to sleep now,
Cooper announced to the seemingly empty air above them.
Good night!
After a few seconds of silence, he non-whispered to Chaz.
I don't want to alarm you, but there's no way I'm getting to sleep now without rubbing one out. I'll turn the other way and try to make it quick, but fair warning, I might get a little gassy.
Chaz willed himself to fall asleep, which he found surprisingly effective. He faded out to the sound of soft grunting. Chapter 32.
Come on, guys,
Dave complained. His back ached and his fingers were beginning to blister.
Isn't this deep enough? It's not like this place is going to be crawling with cops and corpse-sniffing dogs. Nobody even knows Murkwort was here.
He was also a little creeped out that he was now in over his head inside the grave he was digging. He was depending on Frank, Rhonda, and Tony the Elf to help him out once he finished, but he couldn't be 100% sure that they weren't just planning to bury him alive. He had fucked everyone over pretty good, and he was a liability. And on top of all that, he suddenly realized he was whining. Frank peeked over the edge.
You're the one who told Cooper to go 7 feet deep when he buried Mordred, just to be on the safe side.
Because it was Cooper. I was intentionally being a dick.
Dave felt a chill run up his spine. He'd been aware, of course, that the avatar of Mordred that Tim had murdered was buried right next to the hole he was digging. They'd chosen that spot because it was out of the way and there wouldn't be a lot of foot traffic or curious eyeballs. A second body now made this area the Horse Head Inn's official body dump. But now that Frank actually said it aloud, Dave couldn't help but be acutely aware that he was less than a foot away from Mordred's worm-ridden, festering corpse.
If you idiots would stop murdering people on the premises, you wouldn't have this problem.
That's not fair. I'm as upset about this as anyone. More so even. I'm in just as deep a shit as you are now. And I have a disease that turns me into a fucking rat monster.
Life isn't fair.
What an asshole.
Come on, Frank. I need to see a cleric. There still might be time to reverse this.
We can discuss that when there isn't a goddamn dead body in the inn. Now quit your bitching and keep digging.
Frank backed out of sight. The cool moisture of exposed deep earth provided a little relief from the afternoon sun, but Dave was still a gritty, sweaty mess. It would almost be a relief to get buried in here, to lie down and let the dirt cool his exposed skin. The relief wouldn't last long once he wasn't able to breathe, of course. How much more relieving would it be to bury that little gnome fucker down here, though? As he flung a shovel full of dirt out of the hole, Dave fantasized about connecting the business end of the shovel with Frank's head. Then he considered what a fucked up thing that was to fantasize about. Then he reasoned that there wasn't any harm in a little fucked up fantasizing. After all, Dave hadn't killed Murkwort on purpose. He didn't know he was aware of it at the time. But Frank knew that Dave had recently contracted lycanthropy and was denying him the opportunity to get treated. Each hour that passed might be making the treatment that much more difficult or even impossible. And here he was spending those precious hours digging a fucking hole. This was slave labor. Dave wondered again, and a little more seriously this time, if they might be planning to bury him alive. The more he thought about it, the more it made sense. This hole wasn't only for Murkwort. He was digging his own grave. When Frank the Fuhrer determined it was deep enough, Tony the Elf and Rhonda would simply toss Murkwort's body down in here with him and start shoveling in dirt. No, that wasn't how Dave was going to go down. He'd been shit on enough, and he wasn't going to let these three assholes have the final shits. It was time to turn the tables. He would bite all three of them, then throw them in the hole. He would relish their sudden changes of heart about going to see a cleric, and then he'd have a nice long piss on them before he started throwing in handfuls of dirt. But first, he had to figure out a way to get the drop on them, and that meant getting out of this hole. He kept shoveling as he thought, so as not to arouse any suspicion. If he started digging sideways and diagonally upward, he'd be able to dig himself a ramp that he could climb out of, but he wouldn't be able to do that quickly enough before someone noticed. He might have a spell that would ease his escape, but the time was an issue there as well. There was no way they would let him sit and pray uninterrupted for an hour to prepare his spells. Then the obvious answer hit him. He was a were-rat. His dwarf rat hybrid form would likely give him a bonus to his dexterity, and his changed form might make climbing out of a hole easier. It couldn't hurt. For all their knowledge of digging tunnels and dwelling in underground caverns, dwarf bodies were the worst design possible for climbing out of holes. How did it work? Did he have to say a trigger phrase like rat form? Best to rule out other options first. If anyone heard him say that and it didn't work, they'd be done with making him suffer the agony and humiliation of digging his own grave and start raining down the dirt on him right then and there. Deciding to give sheer force of willpower a shot, he shoveled one more scoop of dirt, then set the shovel down. He shut his eyes and focused on what the transformation from dwarf to hybrid rat form might feel like. His fingers and toes started to tingle first, then started to hurt. The pain grew excruciating as his bones stretched. He knew he could make the pain stop any time he wanted, but forced himself to think about how much worse it would feel to breathe in that first lungful of dirt. Choking with no oxygen coming in until he finally succumbed to an agonizing death. He could deal with some stretching bones. It wouldn't last long. The tingling sensation ran through his hands and feet, then up to his elbows and knees. The knees were the worst, but he willed himself to fight through the pain. He had an easier time when it reached his hips and shoulders. It still hurt a lot, but he was learning how to deal with it better, or so he thought. When his internal organs started to change and shift themselves around, he wanted to scream. But his face was elongating, and he had no control over his lungs. Likewise, his control over his sphincter muscle failed him, and he felt squishy warmth fill the back of his pants. That was really the point of no return. Being buried alive was one thing, but he couldn't let the final witnesses to his existence know that the last thing he did before his death was to shit himself. At least not at his age. His armor suddenly felt looser, then he felt like he was being hugged by a crowd of cacti as every pore on his skin forced out coarse gray hairs. Then, all the pain stopped at once. The transformation was complete. Dave held up his hands. His fingertips ended in sharp claws, which seemed more effective than a shovel at tearing through this dirt. His forearms were slender and covered with gray fur. Even the leopard fur on his left arm was a shade grayer. He felt slimmer and more agile, like he'd easily be able to parkour his way out of the hole, but first he'd need to get rid of this armor. Not only was it weighing him down,
but it was wrong for his current body style, more of a hindrance than protection.
"Jesus Christ, Dave,"
said Frank, as Dave frantically worked the buckles on his armor.
"Was that a fart? Or did you go full Cooper and... Oh, shit!"
Frank was standing at the side of the hole again, gawking down at Dave. Fortunately, Dave's fingers were much nimbler now, and he'd already gotten his backplate and breastplate unbuckled.
"Rhonda!" cried Frank. "Tony the... Ooh!"
Dave hurled his breastplate at Frank, striking him in the forehead. There was no going back now. He slipped out of the rest of his armor and tore away the padding and shit-caked undergarments, freeing a tail he suddenly realized he had. After using some of the scraps to wipe his rat person ass clean, he tossed the shovel out of the hole so that he wouldn't be completely unarmed. Then he leaped at a wall and used his right foot to shove his way up to the opposite side of the hole, where he easily grabbed hold of the edge and pulled himself out. Frank lay unconscious, bleeding from the forehead. Dave nodded, self-satisfied with such a badass move. He picked up the shovel and thought about what to do with Frank. Squeezing the shovel handle, he thought about how easy it would be to give him a swift and painless death right now. That would be the practical option, especially since Rhonda and Tony the Elf might show up at any moment. If it were Rhonda or Tony the Elf, he would have gone for the quick death, but he was sure Frank was the mastermind behind the idea to bury him alive. He needed to see Frank suffer. Dave dropped to his knees next to Frank, licked the bleeding wound on his forehead, then spat in his mouth.
"No!"
cried Tony the Elf, lunging at Dave with a machete. Dave barely had time to register what was happening. He instinctively raised his right arm to block the attack. As he fell backwards, he saw that the blade came away a little bloodied, and there was a little bit of blood on his forearm, which he could only presume was his own, but there was no actual wound. The strike had smarted a bit at the moment of contact, but it felt fine now, as if Tony the Elf had attacked him with a plastic prop machete. Then he remembered. Lycanthropes got a pretty steep damage reduction from attacks by anything except silver or...
"Magic missile!"
said Rhonda. Two golden bolts of magical energy flew out from her palms and struck Dave on the right side of his chest and on his left shoulder. Those hurt like sons of bitches and remained hurting. He received no damage reduction from magical attacks. At least the jig was up. No more pretense about it. They were actively trying to murder him now.
"Whoa!"
said Tony the Elf, holding up his left hand at Rhonda and his machete-wielding right hand at Dave.
"Everybody calm the fuck down."
Dave smiled to himself. It was pretty rich of Tony the Elf to tell everyone to calm down right after he'd attacked Dave with a fucking machete. Now that he knew that his machete was about as effective as his dick in his hand, he was suddenly the fucking Prince of Peace. He could probably take them both down right now without breaking a sweat. After all, there were only so many magic missile spells Rhonda could have memorized, and Tony the Elf wasn't armed with any weapons that could hurt him. Still, they might overpower him, tie him up, toss him back in the hole, and get back to the task of burying him alive. All the damage reduction in the world wouldn't save him from suffocation. Now wasn't the time to fight. Now was the time to escape, let his body heal, and figure out how to get rid of his affliction. Anyway, Frank might have a little surprise in store for them tonight. Hell, it might even work out that Dave could pin Murkwort on Frank if anyone asked.
"Everybody be cool,"
Tony the Elf continued, as if he had any control whatsoever of this situation.
"Dave, just back away from Frank, and we can all talk this out."
Dave considered standing there defiantly, challenging Tony the Elf to pull some sort of consequence out of his ass for not obeying. But backing away from Frank, as it turned out, would facilitate Dave's escape. At present, Tony the Elf, Rhonda, and the hole had him kind of surrounded. He could probably jump over the hole with no problem, but falling into it with both of them right there to do a rush burial wasn't a risk he was keen to take. A couple of steps back away from Frank and Rhonda and Tony the Elf would give him the path he needed to make a break for it. Tony the Elf glared at Dave like he was daring him to bend down and pick up the shovel as he backed away from them.
"Just go away and never come back," said Tony the Elf. "If we see you here again, we'll be prepared."
Those were some mighty tough words to essentially convey they weren't currently prepared. Still, Dave chose not to pick up the shovel. The reward wasn't worth the risk of being tackled and subdued. When he had a clear path, he bolted away as fast as he could, which was considerably faster than his normal dwarf running speed. The air rushing past his fur-covered face at that speed was exhilarating.
That is, until he noticed Cardinian NPCs staring at him. Many cowered away, but some drew weapons and stepped in front of their loved ones. Shit, Dave muttered to himself.